Welcome to the Maintainable Software Podcast, where we explore the art of improving existing software with seasoned practitioners who have helped organizations overcome the problems often associated with technical debt and legacy code. I'm your host, Robbie Russell. On this episode, Esther Olatunde, who is currently a senior product engineer at Intercom. Esther joins us from Dublin, Ireland. Esther Olatunde, welcome to Maintainable.
Thanks for having me, Robbie.
Really looking forward to diving into some fun conversations with you today. So, first question. As you reflect on your experience in the industry, what do you believe are a few common characteristics of, dare I say, well-maintained software?
Cool. Yeah, I think of a well-maintained software from the lens, from two lenses, one from the users, like consumers of the software, and also from the lens of like the coders and maintainers of the software. So from the users, you know, I think of it as like, you know, what's the quality of the software? How buggy is it? Like there's a certain level of quality that users have come to expect for software products. So I think, there are things, even if it's not like a consumer application and it's just an API level service, you know, people expect certain level of, you know, service level objectives, you know. So I consider that, you know, one of the traits of a well-maintained software, like, how available is it, the availability, durability, and I think those things are quite important. And from the lens of the coders and maintainers of software, I consider one of it as how easy is it for someone new to the code base to get started and become productive on the software? Is it to get a change through to production? Also, like, if can I spin this whole service or system off on a completely new platform? Like, how easy is it to get that done? So those are the things I consider when I think of well-maintained software from my experience in the industry.
Nice. Do you specifically, we're thinking through the lens of coders, and you're mentioning like users have certain expectations of the software that they're interfacing with. You know, when you think about working in an organization, you know, as mentioned in the intro, you work at Intercom, but like entity with a fairly decent sized engineering team. How do you think about when it comes to a couple of things you just mentioned there, in particular like onboarding or like getting people acclimated? Do you measure that something like that in days, hours? Does it take like weeks before you could join it? Like, what's been your experience on like, what do you think is like an optimal amount of time for someone to be able to make some meaningful contributions to a piece of software and wrap their head around it?
Personally, like depending on how complex a system is, I think personally, a personal metric that I look at is how easy can I make a contribution in week one. Like I try to kind of, you know, evaluate, is the system up to date? Is it well maintained? I try to consider like week one, like how easy can they introduce a change? And it doesn't have to be like a big change. Like, can they set up the code base? Can they have it running locally on their development environment? And can they ship even a one-liner change, you know, quickly? And I think a week is enough to kind of like quantify that metric. And I think for big, it depends on the change. For bigger changes, of course, like, you know, that depends on like the team you're on and the type of change, like then that estimate changes a lot. But I think for the metric of I'm new, getting onboarded, within a week I should be able to set up the code base, have it running on my machine and ship a liner change.
Sure, sure. You know, I work in, you know, you work at an organization like in a product space. I work in the consulting side of things in my world. And one of the things that I'm always encouraging companies to think about is like, if you're going to bring in a team like us or hire an external contractor to work on your project, does it take more than a few days or a week for a fairly experienced engineer to, let's say, change the, like, add like an HTML comment to like the bottom of a web page on your web app and deploy that? Like, how many steps do you need to go through to get to the point where you can just add literally a comment that you can only see if you view source on like the website. So that's like, to me, it's like a quick test. Like, you're not going to break anything. Does that take a week? Does it take 2 weeks to be able to wrap your head around how to make that happen? So it's always, I'm always trying to measure that as like at least a small little benchmark to think about. But no, I like that. Do you, how do you kind of balance, say, like delivering say top-notch quality for your end users while still ensuring that your software remains well-maintained for the engineers? How do you balance those types of things? Or do you feel like it kind of, they go hand in hand?
I think as a company as big as Intercom, I think we're kind of lucky in the sense that the way different teams have been shaped, like we have the product teams and we have the infra teams and like the builder tools team. Like, so we have teams that, you know, help us keep tools up to date, you know, upgrading to the latest versions of different packages. We have team dedicated to that, and we have team upgrading, and we care about like our design system. So if you're on, I am on a product team. So if you're on a product team, you're kind of like, that part is, you're kind of like, that part is kind of abstracted from you. And if you, there have been situations where like product teams need to introduce like a package or update a package, like there are people on the on infra team that you can ping and you can pair on that to, you know, ship that. So I quite like that setup. But before I joined Intercom, I've been here for 3 years now, but before I joined, all my experience has been in startups and smaller companies. So yeah, like that's what I think, like the system that we have at Intercom, like I find that incredibly lucky for product engineers. But on a smaller team, you it's hard, like you rarely have that advantage. You kind of have to care about keeping packages up to date yourself, as well as keeping, you know, shipping quality code. So I think what I have done in the past, like I worked on a consulting company as well, where you kind of like build software for startups. And one of the things we do is while we're maintaining the software, you kind of like keep track of the things that you need to update and try and update them along the way. And there, because most of them were like Rails applications at my time at that agency, like there are certain things we keep in mind as well, like things like, you know, you're kind of aware of like this version of this gem, like you keep an eye on it and like when the end of life is and try and update that. And there are days where, you know, there are weeks actually, you know, where we're like, okay, X percentage of your billable hour, you know, you use it towards like maintenance work, like, you know, upgrading packages, like keeping things up to date. And there are times where it's like, it's just new product development and shipping new features to customers. So I think you have to kind of have a balance when you're working on software like that. Like certain things, if you focus too much on shipping new features and you neglect the packages, the tools that you actually use to build those features, like there are situations where things would grind to a halt and like it will take you a lot longer when you come back to actually updating the system to actually get that code base productive again.
Do you use the metaphor technical debt very often?
Yes, we do.
What do you consider to be technical debt versus, like, well, I'll just leave that kind of as an open question, open-ended.
Yeah. So right now, things I consider technical debt are for this particular architecture that we have, this particular repository that we have, or this particular service that we have, like, you know, there are growing pains of like, oh, I wish this was refactored better. I wish, I know there's this issue I need to work on to make this customer happy, or this set of new features I need to build quickly. But I know that if we do X, Y, Z, like refactor this slightly better, tweak the interface a little bit better, like the life of myself and other developers working on this repository will be better. That list keeps growing, you know. And so those are the things right now that I consider technical debt. And there are times where you kind of have to push for that and advocate for that and, you know, make that call with the team and be like, you know, guys, we absolutely need to do this. We need to dedicate a week or two to doing this refactoring or re-architecting the way this particular interface works. So yeah, right now, directly answer your question, the things I consider technical debt are, you know, big refactoring changes. And like, it doesn't even have to be like huge, like let's rewrite this or service, not that, like, you know, just tiny, let's refactor this class, let's, you know, introduce this new column, like, because that will make this interface read a lot better. Let's actually delete some code that we're not using anymore. Even that, you know, those are things that go on my list of technical debts.
Nice. Yeah, I was curious, if do you feel like your perspective or definition of what technical debt has changed over the years, that you might have considered to be something different 5+ years ago than how you kind of look at it now?
Yes, totally. I think earlier in my career, and you know, when I was working with small companies and small startups, technical debts usually are, oh, we need to upgrade this package, or even something as big as we need to move off this like hosting platform to the other, like something that big, because for whatever reason, like for some of it are technical, some of it are business case reason, we need to kind of make this huge change. Those are the things that go on my list of technical debts. But now it's mostly, I would say it's mostly like refactoring and sometimes upgrading packages, you know, because certain things just, at some point, the longer you leave them, the more painful it is. I don't think it's changed that widely. It's more just like my frame of reference. It's kind of just things that I care about now. It's just a lot narrower, I guess, that will come under the list of technical debt. Like the bigger things, you know, I think will fall onto the bigger teams responsible for, like, you know, the infrastructure or the builder tools.
Hey folks, it's me, Robbie. I want you to take a moment and close your eyes. Now picture your code and your applications as a symphony. Now to keep that symphony playing smoothly, you need an orchestra of tools. That's where our podcast sponsor, AppSignal, takes center stage. They combine the elegance of error tracking, the precision of performance monitoring, and the harmony of logging into one symphonic suite. Whether you're composing with Ruby, jamming with Elixir, orchestrating with Node.js, or harmonizing with Python, or maybe even a little bit of flourish of JavaScript, AppSignal's got the sheet music for you. And here's the crescendo. Plans start at just $23 US a month. That's got to be music to your budget's ears. Plus, they're certified ISO 27001, and they dance the GDPR and HIPAA compliance beats. So don't miss a beat, my friends. Head on over to appsignal.com and tell them that your good friend Robbie from Maintainable sent you. Now, open your eyes and let the symphony of smooth coding begin. Let's get back to our show.
That's true. I hadn't thought about that part of it, is when you are part of an organization that can invest in having teams that are kind of like focused on, as you said, like having a tools team that's just looking at keeping things updated and upgraded and the latest and greatest, so that you're not worrying about that. So I guess it makes sense that that's not going to be at the top of your mind. Like, I got this huge list of like, when are we going to deal with this overdue upgrade or something? And when you're a smaller team and you're doing more of everything, then those are going to be on your list. And so I think it's an interesting perspective that I think that some of my guests haven't maybe had that experience of working at maybe a lot smaller companies or startups, or where they were kind of like wearing multiple hats and doing different things, like thinking about the infrastructure as well, where some organizations just have, I would say, a benefit and of having people that are going to be able to specialize on that. I think that's an interesting kind of takeaway there. Do you feel, something I'm always curious about, since I didn't know that you had previously worked at an agency, and was that early on in your career?
Yeah, that was early on in my career. That was 5 or 6 years ago. Yeah.
And there's something I'm always curious about, because I've been working in the consulting agency world for 20 years now, that when people are joining this industry, I'm always curious to hear people's perspective. Do you think it's, if you were going to find your first like job or two in the software industry, how do you kind of compare? Would you recommend someone go into a consulting agency type direction first, or try to get a job at a product company? Or do you think it doesn't really matter? Or do you feel like there's maybe benefits to going one way or another?
I think I would recommend the agency, mostly because I have a huge bias for knowing everything about everything. And yeah, so I think my agency experience helped me to learn how to build software from scratch, like from initial commit to, you know, and to like when you have like thousands of users, like being able to go through that journey, I think is pretty invaluable in my experience. Personally speaking, I quite enjoyed even just the whole process of working with a startup or a company from like an idea stage, like this is what you want to build, tell me about it. And then being able to map that out into like stories and then, you know, breaking that down into things you can ship and launching that and then helping them manage that. So you're kind of exposed to all aspects of that. Like in the agency I work with, I was exposed to all parts of that, and that was really fun. I enjoyed that. And so I think that's kind of why I would recommend that part. But I know like that's also tricky. Like if you're pretty new in your career, like it can be a bit daunting as well, you know. So having joining a well-established product team where you're just focused on just your tiny piece can be useful. But I personally enjoy being able to go through that process from like the very early stage to having a launch product. Like I think that I enjoy that experience the most. And I actually also started my startup as well. So I kind of think like just going through that experience, like I have that bias of starting something from scratch and then seeing it launching in the hands of people. I think that's pretty cool. You get that as well on a well-established team, like, you know, whatever feature you ship, like you get a lot more, I think, because it's used by millions of people. It's a whole different experience, really. Like, I think it's apples and oranges, honestly, if we're comparing. So if you can build something and then the impact of how many people is using it and like the things you need to think about that you probably wouldn't think about when it's a small code base as well. So it is, I think, two different experiences. I enjoy knowing about everything. I don't know if that correctly answers your question, but like that's my opinion on that.
I think it's illuminating, and I think there's, you know, even like your experience working at an agency is probably a lot different than developers that work at my agency, because we tend to come into projects that have been around and existing for several years, and we come in 5-10 years later and work on them, where you got to work at an agency. So you're even just helping remind me that there's agencies that are focused a lot more on the early stages of a product or a web application or some sort of software project. So there's companies that specialize there, and there's companies that specialize in what my company does, which is come in 3 to 5 years down the road and help those companies. And then there's product companies. Sometimes we have interns at my company almost every, you know, like 3 to 4 months, we'll have a couple of interns and we'll have conversations about, because we're not going to hire them. We're just having, you know, they'll come in for a couple months and then we're like, we try to help encourage them to think about, you know, how they're going to, what kind of companies they're going to send in applications for and try to get a job at. And I'll ask them, I'm like, what kind of company do you want to work at? And they'll be like, well, I like Ruby on Rails, or I like this technology stack. And I'm like, okay, but like what kind of company? Because there's different types of, you like want to work at the product company because they just use that technology, or is it because you want to work with startups, or you want to work with an established company and you can kind of really sink into really understanding one, that product, and like really understand that and think about that customers and just work in that space for the next several years. Or if you work at an agency, you might work on 10 different clients in a year that have completely different types of businesses. And that's a whole different experience, but you might get exposed. And so I know that I feel I'm biased. That I often will say, if you want to deep dive into everything, work at a, go try to get a job at an agency. If you want a deep dive into like the product world and like find your space on a team and that's going to be there for a long time, there's a lot of new problems, but you're going to probably get specialized in working in a certain area of their software product, and there'll be a lot of different types of opportunities there, and you can learn a lot of other interesting things. So I don't think it's one's better than the other. It's just very different. And if you're not maybe good at context switching a lot, and maybe agency world might not be for you, but it doesn't mean I'm assuming there's probably a lot of context switching in a product company as well. It's just, you know, half your day you're talking about one client, then you got to switch over in completely a different business. And you're like, I'm working in finance, and then I'm working in for some insurance company the next day, or some education company 2 days later. And it's like, what does this company do? Anyway, so.
Yeah, that's actually why, you know, I left the agency. Like, I kind of like quite enjoyed being able to work on different, on like mostly the technology part, being able to work on different pieces of the software. But like, I quite miss being able to dig into one product and dig into it for as long as possible. Yeah, like with an agency, you are switching projects monthly. I think there are pros and cons to different types of companies that you work with. And it's about like optimizing for like what interests you or what energizes you at that particular point in time, I guess. Yeah.
Appreciate that. All right, let's switch gears for a little bit and harp too far down this agency versus product world. The answer is the grass is maybe greener on the other side, but maybe the grass is always green. You live in Ireland. Isn't the grass usually green there?
Always green, yeah, when it's not raining.
I live in Portland, Oregon in the United States, and it rains here all the time too. So I don't know. I should maybe look this up and see if we get more rain. We might get more rain than you. I don't know that for a fact, though. But
that would be surprising.
As a ginger, I don't like a lot of sun, so I intentionally moved to a very cloudy, rainy city to not have to spend a lot of money on sunblock or sunlotion. All right. So with AI tools, like that pivot there, like Copilot becoming more prevalent, how do you think our roles as software engineers might evolve?
Yeah, I have been thinking a lot about that. That is pretty interesting. I think our roles as software engineers would be, you know, I was actually speaking with a colleague about this yesterday. Like, we were thinking within 5 to 10 years, like, our roles as software engineers will radically change. So I think right now with Copilot, like, it can essentially be your pairing buddy, like not in the literal sense, but that's the kind of way I found myself using Copilot these days, where you kind of like, it helps guide you, and it also certainly makes you faster depending on what you're doing. But then like that, I think it's a useful tool for experienced developers. I'm not sure how useful it is for new engineers getting into this space, like more because like I think like sometimes it's very wrong and it's so confidently wrong, so if you don't know what you're doing, it could lead you astray. So that part, like, I would tread carefully there. But you know, I think in future I see it becoming a pairing buddy. Like, I think our role as engineers in future would totally change. It would be us, like, this is out there. It would be us essentially. I don't know how it would be like. Would I still be writing Python or Ruby? Would I still be writing JavaScript? Probably, but I think, you know, the way I would write it would change. That's kind of the way I see it. I'm not exactly sure of how that would look like exactly, but I think we might not be writing software the way we write software these days, but you know, we might be doing something completely different, writing some other type of code. But I think AI, you know, as a software engineer, I think the type of software we'll write will be different. It's what I'm leaning towards. Like, in 5 to 10 years from now, I think it would be radically different.
Yeah, I'm trying to wrap my head around it too. And, you know, I know I talk about this on the podcast, that I don't think about my podcast as being like, let's talk about what's shiny and new in the industry. There's a lot of podcasts. I want to talk about, like, let's dealing with like legacy code and technical debt problems and improving existing software. But I think that's where things like Copilot and AI tools are potentially going to be really helpful in some ways, is helping us maybe quick, better, like you talked about earlier, about helping people get onboarded quickly. And like, how much is like the tooling going to be able to help guide someone like, hi, this is, I'm trying to wrap my head around like this idea of around like if someone's starting a company and they could be like, okay, cool. I'm now interface. I pull up my editor. I got like some sort of tool, like another window right here or panel that it looks like you're new here. Let me help show, let me show you around, you know, like I'm a, like it's your buddy, you know, it's your coding buddy you get when you start a company. And then what's it going to do? And then like, how is it going to be tailored to what that person's skill sets is? And like, hey, I already know that you, like, it seems like you're, we hired you. I looked at your resume and you seemed like you're going to be really helpful on the platform team or the tools team. So let's talk about that part of it rather than, you know, and like, how do you start having questions? Like, hey, can you tell me a little bit about the domain modeling? And then like, you're like, that's interesting. And I don't know what that's going to look like either. And so I find it fascinating, but I do, and I keep thinking, one of the things I'm trying to wrap my head around is like reminding myself to use these tools when I'm looking at some existing code and be like, all right, so what is this doing? And then like, I'll look at some code and I might ask Copilot to explain something to me. And I'm like, how different is it? And then I'll like ask it, like, can you help me refactor this a little bit? And it's like, like what you said is like how it could be so confidently wrong sometimes. And like, you're like, oh, that's not working. And you have to like, you're still having to like if you're pairing with someone, you would be correcting them or let them experiment and be like, no, I don't think that's going to work, but you need to kind of figure that out. But this is interesting. Are you actively using it pretty regularly, like the tooling right now in your day-to-day work?
Yeah, I've started using it day-to-day. Like it is fascinating, especially in the space of like documentation that you were talking about there. I think definitely that would help. Like documentation is a big problem for like dev teams, like especially big ones where, you know, like there is different train of thoughts and argument out there, like how well documented a code base should be, and should you leave comments on code and all of that. I think that problem or that debate could be solved by using AI. Like, okay, this, I have this class, what does this do? Like, walk me through that. Or in like, you know, like helping you quickly grok like a system model or like, you know, a particular functionality in a code base. Like I find that it is so smart with that, like in the way I use it. Like, so you're trying to modify or change a particular thing, it's kind of just aware of other parts of the code base that you might not be aware of, that you have to kind of like click through and to kind of find it. I found that surprisingly, like Copilot is aware of those people. I'm like, but where, how do you know about it? And I have to go look for them. Like, oh, there you are. But then I wasn't aware of it. Like, if it didn't make me aware of that, I it would have taken me longer to kind of find, I probably would have figured that out eventually, but it would have just taken me longer. So I think it's more about like the speed of like grokking a code base, like understanding a code base. I think that easily, you know, we will get it pretty quickly if we're not there yet. So yeah, I found another thing that I found, the way I used it recently, last week, was I was trying to like understand some regex or like understand why some regex is not doing what I expected to do, you know? And like, you know, it quickly just told me, oh yeah, this is why, you know? So that was pretty invaluable. I found that pretty cool. Like, I mean, it saved me a lot of clicks. I would have gone to Stack Overflow and all of that, or ping a buddy and like pair with them to figure that out, or, you know, try a few things. But I was just able to kind of like get help right in my editor. Oh yeah, this is what I missed or what I didn't understand about this regex.
We'll be back with our interview with Esther in just a moment. Hi, it's me, Robbie. I just wanted to take a quick moment to say thank you for making time to listen to the Maintainable Software Podcast. If you're finding these conversations valuable, please consider sharing the link amongst your peers and or writing a review on Apple Podcasts to help spread the word. Also, do you know someone that you think I should have on the podcast? Shoot me an email to Robbie with a Y at maintainable.fm and state your case. And now, let's get back to our interview with Esther Olatunde.
Yeah, the regular expressions part definitely is something I've leaned on quite a bit. And it's also been like helpful to be like, I found some weird things where I was for like a month or two, I was trying to figure something out and I was like, I'll come back to this another day. It wasn't like a huge issue, but it was just something that was kind of bugging me. And I'm like, this will
make things more efficient with one of the projects I'm working on. And then one day I just had this thought, I'm like, oh, I should ask Copilot. And then like 20 minutes later, I'm like, oh, figured it out, you know? And I'm like, and it helped generate some tests for me. And I was like, okay, this is cool. I can dig this. And thank you GitHub for the complimentary Copilot license because of my Z-Shell. That's why I've been able to use it. But my team's also using ChatGPT quite a bit and using some of that stuff and then, you know, doing the copy paste and stuff. But I do like having, I'm finding that I like Copilot quite a bit and want to keep experimenting with it. But is it coming for our jobs? Maybe, maybe not.
I don't think so. Like, I don't think so. I think it's still a long way from coming for our jobs. I think there's also a bit of creativity in our job, like beyond. So like there is a train of thought, like, you know, there are like the things you can automate. Part of our job, yes, like it is coming for that. But like there are things about our job as software engineers, like that I just think AI would not be able to do. So that's why I think our job would morph in a certain way. I don't know exactly how, but I think it would just be different from what it is right now. Yeah, it's like saying AI is coming for artists. Like, I fundamentally don't agree, because, like, you know, there are really talented and creative artists there, and like the work they produce, like I can still get artworks from, you know, a human artist. I like those kind of work, like the creative piece. I think that job is gonna be there, but the part of our job that you can automate, I see it as a tool, like that helps you improve, that would improve how we do our job.
I get that. I think the other thing I keep trying to remind myself is, like, I wonder how we get acclimated to being able to maybe move through decision-making quicker in a way. Is like, how will, like, if you think about it, like, there's always, like, every piece of software tends to have this huge backlog of, like, ideas and things that we want to work on. And quite often, a lot of that stuff doesn't get done for a long time, or if ever, because, and other things get prioritized because humans can only think and act and deliver on those ideas so quickly. So if somehow some of the implementation part can be sped up, maybe exponentially, then we might unlock, or we might be able to experiment with things far quicker and it'll be faster, but then, like, because our competitors are all going to be doing this quicker and faster. And so we'll all collectively probably do things a lot faster, like go through things quicker, but it may not actually feel that different day to day for the next generation of people coming in the industry, because they're like, oh, has it always been like that? They're like, it used to take you how long to build something, you know, to build a new feature? Like, it took you 3 weeks to go through idea, design, you know, QA, production, deployment. And they're like, we can do that in like 15 minutes now, or maybe not. I might be overthinking that, but like if we use a design pattern and just like, I have this idea and let's experiment this for like 20% of our users, go. That might be wild and crazy too, though. I don't know how we keep up.
Yeah, but that would be fun. And then you have time to do like other things, like to focus on, like, you know, other higher priority things and the like creative problem solving part of our job.
Like dealing with technical debt, or can we outsource that? And maybe the whole point of, maybe this podcast is just going to be a collection of conversations from people just before the AI bots took all that work away from us. And we can just focus on what's new and shiny. And this was the last snapshot. That's what this podcast is now going to become. It's just going to be an archive before we didn't have to.
Before they take over. Yeah.
Before it just deals all the refactoring problems that we've had to deal with forever. All right. So a couple of quick last questions for you. So, you know, you mentioned, you know, when you were working at a smaller place where you might not always be able to, like, let's imagine there's some listeners out there who are working at a smaller company. They're not working at a place like Intercom, where they have maybe a tools and infrastructure teams that can focus on dealing with those types of things, but they're kind of responsible for taking care of most of that themselves. Do you have any advice on how they could better advocate for themselves to get the approval to work on addressing some of those technical debt problems, those things that are like slowing their team down, but it might not be necessarily the high priority for the their, you know, whoever's in charge of the product backlog prioritization?
Yeah, I think I found the way it's the way to talk about that, to kind of like make your case for this type of project, is kind of like one of the things that might be missing. Like, I think it's easy to, as a developer, to kind of just say, oh, I need to update this package, I need to refactor this code because it sucks. And like, the person you're talking to is like, okay, but this works. You know, people are using this. Like, why do I care? Like, you wouldn't actually, like, it's not, no customer is complaining about what your code looks like. Yeah, you know, this it's working. So it's hard to justify that. I think the way I try to advocate for work like that is to like let them know that, like, okay, you know, this, try to demonstrate to them that if this particular refactoring or package update doesn't get done now and soon, like the next time you want to kind of introduce this new set of features, like how long that is going to take, like the, you know, that is going to take longer. I think advocating for that, making it obvious that, oh yeah, this would kind of lead to duplicated work, basically speaking from the lens of like the value to them, like they care about how long things will take, you know, like advocating for, okay, if we do this work now, you won't see the impact. Yes, sure. But like you see the impact, like, you know, 3 months down the line, like teach the benefits of doing this type of work. I think it's usually long term, and like it's harder to kind of like advocate for them in an environment where people care about like the short term benefit of stuff. So I would kind of like try to paint the picture of what they would get in the long term. And another thing, when sometimes that doesn't work, but what I think I work on during my agency days, I worked on a project on a code base where they were on very, very old version of Rails, and they kind of like didn't want to do any work, like to kind of upgrade that, but they wanted to keep modifying and adding stuff. And like, it actually was painful to work on that project, like to clearly, you know, we need to take a few weeks to do the upgrade, like test. And then if we do that, all the new things you want to add will be faster rather than, you know, and ultimately at the end of the day, it would amount to the same time, because if this particular tiny thing you want to add, it's taking longer because the system is old, all the different functionalities, you have to kind of like, you know, look for like the older version to be able to prove that code base. Like, it was actually slowing everybody working on that system down. It was hard to even like get new people to join the team and add any feature, because like nobody wants to work on that kind, because it's just such a pain. Communicating from that when it's already bad, it's easier. Like we have to do this now, otherwise it's gonna get worse, and it's gonna affect you make being able to introduce new changes to that. So like that's kind of, I would teach that. Even at a company of like Intercom size, there are certain situations where you need to advocate for, let's do this technical debt work, because if we don't do this technical debt work, we can add new set of features to this, because it would take longer. It's usually a negotiation. I think most developers understand, and you don't need to pitch maintenance work. It usually is a negotiation when you're talking to odd non-devs about maintenance work. Usually look at it in the interim, like, okay, what does this give me? Like, nothing. But like, like no, it gives nothing to the user. But, you know, then you explain all the benefit. Like, oh yeah, the next time we want to update this, it's better, it's faster for someone to add the feature. Like, I think, you know, the gain is long-term, like finding a way to negotiate that and like paint that picture is kind of like what I typically focus on.
No, I like that. I think that's some good thoughts there around how to navigate that. I like that around thinking about it. It's always a negotiation. And then I also appreciate your perspective of these different types of work environments you've been a part of. I always think that there's there's people that are probably listening that are part of a team where maybe they've asked and pitched something and they said, hey, can we take care of this? And they heard, not right now, maybe later, maybe another time. But maybe they heard that once or twice, or and so they stop asking. And that's the thing I'm always worried about is like, if you're listening and you feel like you've asked and you're like, well, they don't care, so I'm just going to stop asking. That's not a great situation for anyone. You're not doing yourself any favor. You're not doing the company any favors. Or maybe you think your coworkers don't care, but someone needs to speak up and deal with it because it's not making, you're not making your life any better. And I think, you know, you could do that right now. You can find ways to start advocating and be like, I know that in the past you said not right now. And like, how about now? Or like, bring it up and like, and just be a squeaky whale. Or I don't, just, do you have any advice for people on how to like, maybe to reapproach that or to get some like energy to come back and try to have that battle one more time before they just think like, well, maybe the only option is I have to go find a new job somewhere where they do care about that, which may or may not actually be the case.
Yeah, I think the level of care is kind of relative depending on companies, but usually like always in negotiation, regardless of company, in my experience. And I think if you're in that situation, you shouldn't give up. I think you should keep advocating for it. If there is a tiny incremental change you could make that would kind of make things better, try and make that. And I think it's also like if trying to get like a clear estimate on, oh, okay, I've done this, I've made this tiny incremental change, this is what that, how that helped. Imagine if I get this small time, this is, you know, how that would help. I think it's more about like keep advocating for it. Like, and I think ultimately, like depending on who the stakeholder is, I'm sure like there are situations where it's about like, okay, so we want this new set of features and then we have this technical debt list, like try, one of the things I also try is try and do at least one item on your technical debt list every sprint, whatever your sprint is, you know, try and put one in. So if it's like you have 100% of your time, maybe 10% of your time, try and do one, you know, and just try, keep trying to figure out. I think it's more just keep advocating for that, because ultimately you're making your life easier, you're making the life of other engineers on your team easier, and if they might not understand it now, you are making the life of the customers easier, you know, because yeah, I think it's because it's usually hard to paint that picture, but if you can maintain and update packages quicker and faster, the rate at which you iterate on a product is faster. Your developer experience, you know, the health of your dev team, they're not demoralized and like de-energized because like the code, you know, if they're not, that also helps with like their motivation and they're able to work faster and better. So all, I think painting the picture from different lenses and advocating for that is what I would advise.
Hey folks, it's me, Robbie again. Just wanted to take a quick moment to plug my own company, Planet Argon. We are a Ruby on Rails consultancy. We've been in business since 2002 and using Ruby on Rails since the beginning of 2005. It's been a few years. And well, we're always on the lookout for our next new fun client. So if you know of a company that's using Ruby on Rails and might be working off of an old outdated version of Ruby and Rails, needs help modernizing their applications, moving away from things like jQuery or React and want to take advantage of all this new fun Hotwire stuff, get in touch. PlanetArgon.com. Again, that's PlanetArgon.com. And now back to the show. I think that's some good advice for those listening. And, you know, you can always, assuming that you have someone that you report to in an organization, you should be bringing these things up. And I think sometimes you got to go a little slower to go faster. You got to clean things up. And those are important things to consider. And the thing I always, when I'm speaking with other business owners or people that are in like product owner roles that are, may or may not be my customer, but when we're having conversations about things that are slowing down their team, I'll just be like, they're asking you for 2 weeks to work on this improvement that's going to make things better for them. How long will you not get things done because you had to replace one of those engineers because they quit and went to go work somewhere else and they walked out with all that knowledge of what needed to be done? That's actually going to take you even more time, and it's hard to calculate that. So anyways, you say all that to say is, yeah, you can, I'm going to say you have to threaten them, but you could just be honest that there's more to it. And employee retention is an important thing. And the developer, you're saying like your engineers, how they're energized is important. So if you're not feeling energized about your code right now, listeners, speak up and advocate for yourself and your coworkers. Last couple of questions for you, Esther. Is there a non-software, non-technical book that you like to recommend to your peers that you can recommend to people?
I read this book recently and I've talked a lot about it to anyone who could listen. And it's, I don't know if it counts because it's not technical and software, but it is this book built by Tony Fadell, like the Unorthodox Guide of Building Things Worth Making. Like, I think he was on the team that made Apple. And yeah, I heard about him for the first time after I watched the General Magic movie about the team that were trying to build the first mobile phone. And I think some people from that team actually ended up building, like, you know, the iPhone and Android. And Tony Fadell was on the team that built the iPhone, and like, so it had like really good insight from those days of how it was trying to figure out what should a phone look like. So I'm pretty like that was pretty interesting. Like, I really, really enjoyed that book, and also like learning from that experience, like imagining how all the thought process that went into, okay, like, you know, this is what this device looks like right now. A lot of people thought about that, you know, and all the different iteration and processes that went through. I really enjoyed that book. That was fascinating.
Great. I will definitely include links to that in the show notes. I wasn't familiar with that particular book, but going on my reading list, I'm interested. Well, thanks for that. Well, with that, it's been such a delight having you join us on Maintainable, Esther. Thank you so much for stopping by to talk shop with us.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, this was fun. It was a fun chat.